Thanks for inviting me into your home, long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' basement, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett, and tonight, this morning, we're coming to you live from Coast's Toronto, Canada affiliate, Talk Radio AM 640. Open lines in the second half of the program. Your opportunity to scramble into the co-pilot's seat aboard the Mothercraft and help me steer this magnificent ship clear on till morning. And as per usual, I've put together a pretty cool mixtape for the road trip. May you live in interesting times. It's an English expression, supposedly a translation of a traditional Chinese curse. Well, seemingly a blessing, the expression is always used ironically, meaning, well, maybe may your life be filled with strife and chaos and conflict. Despite being so common in English as to be known as the Chinese curse, the saying is apocryphal. Didn't happen. There is no actual Chinese source that has ever been produced. So there's a little takeaway courtesy of Coast to Coast AM, and you can throw that out there in the kitchen tomorrow morning and impress the person who makes your eggs. Be that as it may, however, we do live in interesting times, and I do use that ironically with the clear implication that uninteresting times of peace and tranquility are more life-enhancing than interesting ones, which from historical perspective usually include disorder and conflict. Interesting times. They do make for good talk radio and great open lines. If you want to talk about whether to take a knee or not to take a knee, North Korea, the threat of EMPs, hurricanes, earthquakes, and that's just the stuff being reported in the MSM. What about the subterranean realm where we coasties love to spelunk? Hey, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base is celebrating its 100th birthday this year. That would be great to talk about. Roswell investigator Don Schmidt, for example, says Wright-Pat and Hangar 18 is the real Area 51. So perhaps a little bit later in the program, there may be some Wright-Pat vets out there who wish to unburden themselves. We can throw that log on the fire. Hey, reality is really, really big, and we can talk about it all. Even though, as John Lennon liked to say, sometimes reality leaves a lot to the imagination. So get your stories and comments and questions ready. Practice in front of a mirror if need be. And then get thee to a telephone, cell phone, Dixie cup, and a piece of string, however you want to communicate with us. So that's open lines, a Friday night institution. And that works out real well because there are a few people who would like to see me institutionalized. But that's another story for another night. A first half of the show. On October the 26th of this year, thousands of top secret documents are scheduled to be released, and those documents could reveal new details about the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Now we're waiting to see whether President Donald Trump will block the release of files that could shed light on a tragedy that has stirred conspiracy theories for decades. The National Archives has, as I say, until October the 26th, to disclose the remaining files related to Kennedy's 1963 assassination, again, unless Trump intervenes. The CIA and the FBI, whose records make up the bulk of this batch, won't say whether they've appealed to the Republican president to keep them under wraps. This year, of course, also marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of the 35th president. This November 22nd, we'll once again commemorate the anniversary of his murder, now 54 years on. Are we any closer to knowing the who, the how, and the why? There are countless theories as to why Oswald couldn't have acted alone or at all. You can certainly count me as highly skeptical of the Warren Report's version of events. Many of us have pieced together a number of possible reasons as to why National Security Action Memorandum Number 263, that had to do with the exit strategy that would have seen all U.S. personnel out of Vietnam by 1965, Executive Order 1110, which gave the U.S. the ability to create its own money backed by silver, which could have undermined the power of the almighty Federal Reserve. Then there was JFK's alleged threat to the CIA that he wanted to splinter the Central Intelligence Agency into a thousand pieces and scatter it to the winds. So CIA Director Alan Dulles was not particularly pleased with Jack. And then, of course, there's the anti-Castro element, who saw Jack as soft on communism, the mob, because of Attorney General brother Bobby. JFK's threat to repeal the oil depletion allowance, that would have cut into the profits of big oil. I'm sure that came up at Clint Murchison's place the night before the assassination. So, we have the industrial military, the military-industrial complex, the banksters, the big oil people, the CIA, the mob, a South Vietnamese drug syndicate. Hell, I'm beginning to think the only one without a gun in Daley Plaza aside from Jack and Jackie was Lady Bird Johnson. Or maybe Nellie Connelly, the First Lady of Texas. She was sitting in the seat in front of Jackie in the presidential motorcade, for those keeping score. The point is, we're diving back into the swamp that is the JFK assassination. And I'm not venturing into these deep waters on my own. Remember the first rule of safety? It's the buddy system. So I've pressed good friend and JFK assassination researcher Don Jeffries into service. And he'll be aiding us during the discussion. Actually, he'll be giving most of the answers, and I'll just ask a few pointed questions. So, there you have tonight's menu, my friends. Open lines in hours 3 and 4, and coming up next in hours 1 and 2, Don Jeffries, author of Hidden History, yet another valiant attempt at unraveling a little bit more of the Gordian knot that is the JFK assassination, the most famous unsolved murder in American history, while there are still those who remember. Think about it, in a few decades, there'll be no one left alive who can say, I remember exactly where I was when JFK was shot. And then John Fitzgerald Kennedy will join presidents like Lincoln and Garfield and McKinley, where the trail has gone cold, a cold case that will remain forever thus. So tonight, we go back to Dallas, November 63, while there's still time. Come on in, weary traveler, hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told. And you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett. This is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Donald Jeffries has been researching the JFK assassination since the mid-70s, when he was a teenage volunteer for Mark Lane's Citizens Committee of Inquiry. He's very active on all the JFK assassination forums and has been a moderator on the London Spartacus Education Forum for several years. His first published book, the acclaimed 2007 novel The Unreals, has been compared to Alice in Wonderland and The Wizard of Oz. Hidden History was first published in 2014. A second expanded edition was published in 2016 as Hidden History, an expose of modern crimes, conspiracies, and cover-ups in American politics, with a foreword by Roger Stone. Don's latest book, which we discussed this past spring on Coast, is Survival of the Richest. Don Jeffries, great to talk to you again, my friend. How are you?
I'm fine, Richard. Thanks for having me.
How is Survival of the Richest doing? How has it been received?
I haven't seen a bad review of it yet. It's been critically received by everyone. It got lots of advanced praise that people can read on Amazon. And I've had people tell me that I've had a couple readers said it changed their lives. You know, so it's great getting that kind of feedback. And I think it's an important work because no one really has looked at the way things work as far as why people make a certain amount of money for one job as opposed to another, and how the marketplace is just completely rigged for the wealthy and the poor.
Yes, we should point out that you address, in Survival of the Richest, you address the massive income disparities in America, the destruction of the middle class, the greed, not of the 1%. I think the 1%, that term is misused. We're talking about the 0.0001%. These are all some of the themes that you discuss, obviously, in the book that were central to the last presidential election in 2016. It's a great book, and all of these themes continue to be, you know, central to not only political discourse, but just this is what people talk about around their kitchen table, what you talk about in Survival of the Richest.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people can relate to it. And, you know, when I was on there before, I think we had callers calling in about that because this is what they go through in their daily lives. So it's something that hits home again with the average workers, and it has that populist theme, and it's why, as you mentioned, both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, why they elicited such a great response from different people was because they were stressing those kind of themes that other politicians don't, the things that people do talk around in their kitchen table about.
Are you ready to dial back to Hidden History?
Absolutely.
The President John F. Kennedy Assassination Records Collection Act of 1992, That really came about, as I understand it, as a result of Oliver Stone's movie JFK. And it was interesting.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting that it was signed into law by President George Herbert Walker Bush. It'll be 25 years ago on the 26th of October. Some people find that interesting. Some say ironic. Maybe we'll get into that later. The Poppy Bush angle, I mean. But explain what the President John F. Kennedy Assassination Records Collection Act, what it decreed, what it was all about.
Well, it was designed to have everything released because, you know, I think there were 30-some thousand documents still that we know of that had not been released yet, which is just amazing to me. I've always said, you know, why is anything being withheld on an event that we were told constantly was perpetrated solely by this one minimum wage loser who had no other contact? So why would anything remain classified? Why would anything, when a lot of these documents are released, as you know, they're heavily redacted. So sometimes they're almost completely worthless because you can't really even tell. There's so much redaction and you don't even know what they're saying. But Oliver Stone's movie did pressure, you know, even President Bush and then later Clinton to sign this into act. And so far, you know, as you said, 25 years later, which would be October 26th this year, they're supposed to be released, and we're waiting on Trump, I guess, to see what he does with his performance so far. I'm not sure anybody can depend on him to, but I think, you know, for instance, even the establishment has said release everything, because I don't think there's going to be any smoking gun in these documents. You know, people always ask that question, and I really don't, whoever the actual conspirators were, I really doubt that they put all their plans on paper and just suppressed it and then would later release it. So I don't think there's going to be any smoking gun, but certainly there's always some interesting information because there's so much information released, and usually it's people like John Newman, if you know, who's gone through
yes.
this, with a fine-tooth comb, and you find something. Like in the preliminary release from a couple months ago, we found something that we'd long suspected. That was a Dallas Mayor Earl Cabell, who was the brother of Charles Cabell, who was a top official in the CIA, and he's one of the three people that was fired by John F. Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs, along with Alan Dulles and Richard Bissell. It was revealed that he was officially a CIA asset. So I think, you know, we'd probably, a lot of us had suspected that, but that's an interesting, you know, connection there to be in that city where he was assassinated and to be connected that way to a high CIA official.
Well, I was going to get to this a little bit later, but since you mentioned the Cabell boys, and we're not talking the baseballers with the Houston Astros, so Earl, you're right. Earl Cabell was mayor of Dallas in '63. His brother Charles. Now, I thought he was deputy director. But here's the big question that always comes up with the relationship between the Cabells, and that is, you know, who had the power to change the parade route, the motorcade, presidential motorcade route? It certainly wouldn't have been the mob. So then you have, you know, the mayor at the time and his relation with the deputy director of the CIA. But I want to ask you about the parade route, and that is whether in fact it was changed, because originally we're told the motorcade was to go directly down Main Street and then right onto the Stemmons Freeway, and that it was supposedly changed at the last minute so that they turned onto Houston and then Elm. And this is sinister because, you know, the route down Elm takes the limo near the grassy knoll where, you know, you could hide a shooter. It also took the motorcade near the other buildings, such as the Dal Tech or the Texas Book Depository building. So, I mean, much has been made of the fact that the parade route was changed last minute. But was it?
I believe it was. On the forums, I kind of popularized the term neocon, as far as not the same neocon that we would have in other parts of politics, but as far as people who believe in, like, have a neo-belief in conspiracy in the JFK case. And that's one of those points that I believe a lot of these critics have capitulated on for no reason at all. And Jim Garrison published in his book On the Trail of the Assassins, he highlighted the fact that there was a commission exhibit that talked about that it was a facsimile of the newspaper that day. And if you've seen that exhibit, I mentioned it in Hidden History, the photograph is blacked out of the motorcade route. And it grayed out. And those are the kind of things that make people wonder. And certainly the motorcade route itself whether it was changed, it made no sense for those, as Fletcher Prouty and others talked about, the hairpin left-hand turn onto Elm. When there was, they could have just gone a much, much easier straight shot under the Stemmons Freeway. They just kind of went out of their way, but they did happen to go by the Texas School Book Depository, of course, and the triangulation of Crossfire, which was in that Dealey Plaza. So I think that there's strong indications that the motorcade route was changed. But again, it's one of those things where a lot of the critics now say, no, it actually wasn't. But I don't think that's a central thesis, but I think there's so much doubt in all of this stuff. And that's one of those ones where an honest investigation could have found out for certain if it had been changed. And they would have talked to people like America Bell and obviously the Secret Service, who, as you know, the Secret Service performance is so suspicious in so many areas that I certainly wouldn't trust anything they said on the matter.
Well, that raises a great issue, and that is how much of the cover-up of the assassination was to conceal the true motives, the true culprits, and the true method of killing the president, and how much of the cover-up has to do with the CIA and the Secret Service and the FBI covering their tracks after the fact because they failed to protect the president?
Well, that's a good question. I sometimes wonder, the cover-up was constructed, and I don't know if you're familiar with Vincent Solandria, who is one of my favorite critics. He never wrote a book, but he wrote lots of articles. And he kind of came upon a theory that I had from the time I was a young man. You know, when I first started reading these critical books and looking at the evidence myself, the first thing that struck me, you know, even as a teenager, is how obvious this was, that Oswald could not possibly have done it. And I thought, you know, from the planning of a pristine bullet, the magic bullet, you know, why wouldn't you plant a bullet that looked like it had actually hit something, you know, instead of a bullet that looked like it had been fired through cotton wad? And those kind of things, just really everything about it was shabbily constructed. And Vincent Solandria, you know, was the first really person to speak publicly about just saying, hey, you know, this cover-up was purposely made. The conspirators wanted us to know that they did it, and it was like an advertisement, and I've come to that conclusion. So I look at it, these were obviously sophisticated people, because I believe there were high-level forces that were behind the assassination, so they could have conducted a really good cover-up, but they chose not to. I mean, things like, if you read the witness testimony, and again, they, as Alan Dulles said early on, you know, the American people don't read, nobody will read, there'll be a few college professors that will read it, but, and he was right, most of the people didn't read it, but some of us did. And if you read the witness testimony of people like Viola Peterman, people like that who never even met Oswald, but had known a neighbor that babysat the infant Oswald, they called her as a witness into the JFK assassination. Why would you possibly do that? That's not a benign cover-up. These are incredibly brilliant lawyers, young legal minds like Arlen Specter, future senator. They knew exactly what they were doing. They were padding the record, and they wanted people like me to look and say, why are they calling her as a witness? But they didn't call Admiral Berkeley, who was one of the most important witnesses imaginable. He was the president's personal physician. He was in the motorcade. He was at Parkland. He was at Bethesda, and he was the recipient of all the medical evidence. Yet they didn't call him as a witness, but they called someone who didn't have any connection at all to the case and really had never even met Oswald. So those are the kind of things that cause people like me and Vincent Solandria to just theorize that this cover-up was purposely transparent. It was made to be exposed, and the criticism that resulted, you know, from the critics like Mark Lane and Harold Weisberg early on, they wanted this kind of controversy, and I don't know why. Maybe it goes back to the old conspiracy credo, order out of chaos, but clearly the cover-up was... If anyone who investigates this for a couple weeks realizes, okay, the official case is impossible. They did an awful job of hiding their tracks. I mean, the Secret Service, obviously, I mean, you know, Emory Roberts, you can see him calling one of the agents back to the car that actually tried to do his job. And, look at the Secret Service agent at the airport, who I believe still, I disagree with my friend Vince Palarama, who believes it was Don Lawton. I believe it was Henry Rutko. Actually ended up talking to his family. I published that in Hidden History, the first
book. Who are these people and why is it significant?
Well, Henry Ripke is, I believe, is a Secret Service agent. If you see the footage you can see on YouTube where at Love Field when the motorcade is just starting, Ripke or the Secret Service agent starts to trot alongside the motorcade as the Secret Service did in a lot of his motorcades. and he's waved off by Emory Roberts, who was the chief in the car that day, and you can see the guy shrug, like, what's up, like, put his hands up, like, clearly he's shocked that he's being told not to come with the motorcade, and it's, to me, it's prima facie evidence.
All right, we'll get into some more prima facie evidence. Don Jeffries is the author of Hidden History. His newest one is Survival of the Richest. We'll get back into the JFK assassination swamp, Gordian knot, pick your own metaphor. And we'll also get to your calls at the bottom of the next hour. Here's, let me see, who is this? This is Etta James. Etta James taking us into the break with I'd Rather Go Blind, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Sitting in for George Norrie. I forgot to mention that off the top. My apologies. I am filling in for the big boss, George Norrie, who I think this is his first day off since Mamie Eisenhower was in the White House. He is, with all due respect to Tony Orlando, George Norrie is the hardest working man in show business. That was Carla Thomas, No Time to Lose. We are going to continue our conversation with Don Jeffries, author of Hidden History about JFK, in just a few moments. I just wanted to throw out a few sort of maybe little-known facts about the 35th president. Did you know that JFK received last rites 5 times in his life? 5 times. In 1947, after becoming gravely ill in England. In 1951, while stricken with a high fever in Japan. In 1954, following complications after back surgery. Again, given last rites. Counted out, of course, on November 22nd in Dallas when he did pass away. But one other time, and this was as a very young child, maybe two, back in his hometown, his childhood home of Brookline, Massachusetts. And at the Kennedy household, he contracted scarlet fever, which at that time could be fatal to children. And a priest was summoned to the Kennedy home, again in Brookline, to administer last rites. And obviously he survived that one, but not the assassin's bullet in 63. 5 times JFK was given last rites. All right. Finally, there is a dating site to find others with similar interests. ParanormalDate.com. It helps you find a match that shares your interest in the paranormal, ghosts, life after death, UFOs, alternative science, Bigfoot. It's free to search and send messages. There are thousands and thousands of members in your area, and ParanormalDate.com is optimized for dating on your cell phone. And I believe now Paranormal.com has crossed the threshold. They now have over 67,000 members. Again, free to sign up. You can use the code word George if you want to investigate further. ParanormalDate.com. Remember, you are not alone. More of my conversation with Don Jeffries on JFK on the other side, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Don Jeffries is with us, the author of Hidden History, and his new one, Survival of the Richest, How the Corruption of the Marketplace and the Disparity of Wealth Created the Greatest Conspiracy of All. We're talking JFK. I'm wondering how much of the cover-up, Don, also had to do with, perhaps, preventing World War III. The idea that the Kremlin and Castro were connected to this assassination, and it could have started World War III, and by some estimates, it could have cost something like 40 million American lives in a nuclear war.
I think that excuse has always been a fallback for the establishment, if the conspiracy was ever, so either that or the Mafia did its thing, perhaps the Castro did its thing. We've heard supposedly that Lyndon Johnson pressured Earl Warren into being by saying, you know, this could be World War III if we don't do this or something. And I've never bought that because I think this was the same reason I don't really pay attention to all the Cuban names that you find involved in this case and connected to this case, because I think all that was a smokescreen. I believe this was something done internally by very powerful forces, and most of them in the United States government, perhaps some of them in corporate America as well, military-industrial complex. I think Oliver Stone got it pretty much right in JFK, you know, where he talked about this kind of consortium of powerful forces that came together. As you mentioned earlier, there were so many people that had a great motive to want JFK out of the White House. and you know, just the NSAM 263 alone, our Vietnam policy, Federal Reserve, the oil companies, CIA. So many people had very strong interests. And this is the guy, the only president I've never known of that rejected the overtures to war over and over again. If you see the film Virtual JFK, it shows you exactly how often, and from the Bay of Pigs on, how JFK kind of pulled the plug on that at the last minute. It wasn't his baby. He took responsibility for it. Looked bad. But from that moment on, he learned a lot, and he learned not to trust the military, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he really just kind of went along with Bobby Kennedy, who he trusted, and some of his Irish mafia people. But he really learned from that experience, and he over and over again rejected the overtures of war from the Cuban Missile Crisis and obviously Vietnam. So I've never bought that, the World War III thing. I think that's a fallback for them to say, well, because then that goes into the benign. There's a lot of the researchers that believe it was a benign cover-up. And as I mentioned earlier about the kind of witnesses that the Warren Commission called and the kind of witnesses they didn't call, I think that just destroys any notion that it was a benign cover-up, because some thought and some effort had to go into locating people like us, you know, someone who knew an Oswald's babysitter when he was an infant. That couldn't have been a person that was easy to track down. But obviously, people like Admiral Berkeley and some of the witnesses that were closest to the limousine, people like the Babushka lady, the Umbrella Man, these kind of shadowy figures that researchers have talked about for decades, and no one still really knows for certain who they were. And they were really important witnesses, and they should have been questioned, obviously, in any real investigation, as should the Secret Service. They should have been grilled mercilessly because they didn't do their job that day. But we saw none of that. And I've never bought that theory.
You mentioned the Bay of Pigs. And I don't know if any documents have come to light this past summer leading up to the big sort of the last dump of documents on October 26th, which is the 25th anniversary of the signing of the Assassination Records Collection Act. But have any documents surfaced or any other prima facie evidence that really nails down the fact that the idea that the Bay of Pigs was really designed to box Kennedy in, that he was opposed to a full scale U.S. military invasion of Cuba. So the idea was that the Bay of Pigs invasion was designed to fail, that there would be just a slaughter on the landing beach, and that would pressure Kennedy into acquiescing and okaying a military invasion, full scale.
I don't know of any documents that prove that clearly. That's an interesting hypothesis, though, and certainly wouldn't put it past the powers that be, because Kennedy really inherited that from the Eisenhower administration, and Richard Nixon really had overseen that. It was obviously a CIA operation from beginning to end, and I think that they believed when Kennedy got in there that this was a naive rich kid, and that he would be easy to bully, and he would be easy to, you know, they could easily get him to go along with their plans, and they weren't used to people in his position ever saying no to them. And Kennedy refused to air support at the last minute, and so many Cubans still hate him to this day because they blame him for it. But he never intended it to be that kind of scale. And again, it was something where he kind of trusted the people not to come up with a fiasco like this, and it was a fiasco. But I've always...
Designed to fail, perhaps.
Yeah, that certainly makes sense, designed to fail. But I've argued this on the forums in the past, you know, people that believe that Castro or a Cuban policy was the, you know, the impetus behind the assassination, they have to explain one thing. And like I've said, once Kennedy was assassinated, Cuba died as a foreign policy issue with America. You look in the history books, I mean, it was never mentioned in the Johnson years, never mentioned to Richard Nixon, the anti-Castro, zealot. Nothing. Nobody tried to topple Castro. If the idea that Kennedy was had to be killed because he was in the way of them overthrowing Castro, well, how come after Kennedy was successfully killed, they never tried to overthrow Castro? I mean, literally, they stopped talking about Cuba. It was, if you look at Cuba as a political issue in America, it was just during the Kennedy years. So I don't buy that at all, but what I look at what did change, and that's what I point out all the time, what changed with his death? Obviously, our Vietnam policy. Obviously, the CIA grew even more powerful. Obviously, if Kennedy was really looking into, and I believe Kennedy knew the real nature of the Federal Reserve, because his father, Joseph Kennedy, a very important figure in his life, knew all about the banks, and he made comments about the Federal Reserve himself. I believe he knew that kind of thing, and whether the executive order really, with the silver-backed certificates and so forth, all those things together, I think, added up to he was just a tremendous threat. And I think those are the reasons we need to look. That's why whenever researchers bring up the Cuban thing, I say that I think that's a smokescreen. I know there were lots and lots of Cuban names involved here and their connections, but I think, as you mentioned with the other thing, I think that was kind of designed to misdirect attention and maybe at one point lead to Castro. I don't know if that was their original design to originally claim Castro did it and then overthrow him, but if that was the case, they never attempted that. And certainly as soon as Kennedy was buried, you never heard any more about Castro. I mean, unless I missed it, he just kind of faded from the American political scene.
Right, right. That quote is often cited, attributed to Kennedy, after Bay of Pigs, that he had threatened to splinter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter to the winds. Has that ever actually been proven to have been attributed to Kennedy? Did he actually say that?
Well, I believe the quote came from Paul Red Fay, who was his Secretary of the Navy, I believe. He'd been one of his PT-109 buddies, and Kennedy was very loyal to his friends, and he was either Secretary of the Navy or Assistant Secretary of the Navy, perhaps. But he wrote a book, one of the many Kennedy's books I read when I was young, and he wrote a memoir about his life, and obviously it featured JFK prominently. And I believe the quote originated with him because I think they were out sailing or something one day, and Kennedy just kind of confided to him, and I believe that's when he made the quote about shattering the CIA into a million pieces into the wind. So Paul Fay claimed he said it. Now, but I don't know why he would. That was a controversial comment for him to publish if he didn't say it.
There is another very controversial, not a quote, but a speech, and we know that Kennedy said it. It was made before the National or American Newspaper Publishers Association. I think it was in 1961. And many of us have heard this speech or parts of it where Kennedy says the very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society, and we are as a people inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. A lot of conspiracy theorists and some JFK assassination researchers insist Kennedy was talking about, I guess, the Illuminati or some secret cabal or maybe what we call the deep state. But I think most historians believe he was talking about the threat of communism. So which is it in your mind?
Well, I don't usually agree with the establishment historians, but I think in that case he probably was talking about communism. But it's a great speech, and certainly the way it was worded, and Kennedy wrote a lot of the speeches, but he wrote them in conjunction with Ted Sorensen, and Ted Sorensen was just a wonderful. All that great JFK rhetoric came from a combination of Kennedy and Sorensen, and the rhetoric in that speech is so great, and it really resonates now with conspiracy theorists, people that it's because it could be applied to anything. It's been applied to Freemasonry, Illuminati, as you said. I mean, any group, really, the deep state. And so I think he probably was talking about communism, but it's also possible that they worded it that way purposely to go beyond communism, because certainly it seems like he is kind of going over the top there with what he was saying, but it's a wonderful speech, and if you play it now, certainly, and this guy was assassinated 2 years later, it really resonates with people because, wow, next to his, really the only other speech I think that compares with it that he gave was his wonderful American University speech, which probably signed his death warrant. Because there's
I was going to ask you, A Strategy of Peace, which was written by Sorensen in part, certainly. The American University speech where he's laying out his vision for the world, and I agree. I think that may have been the nail in the coffin. There's another quote that's attributed to Kennedy. We're kind of separating the wheat from the chaff here tonight with Don Jeffries, author of A Hidden History. His newest is Survival of the Richest, and it's, again, often attributed to Kennedy, although I don't know if he ever said it. And he supposedly uttered these words a mere 7 days before his assassination. And he said, supposedly, there's a plot in this country to enslave every man, woman, and child. Before I leave this high and noble office, I intend to expose this plot. Have you ever tried to track that down to see if Kennedy actually said that?
I have tried to track it down. He supposedly said it at Columbia University, I believe. And I would like to believe he said that, because, boy, that would certainly be a fitting, epitaph for him, you know, a few days before his assassination. But I can't find any record of it, that he gave a speech at Columbia University at that time, let alone said those words. So I don't know where that came from. And that's you do have to be careful researching these things, because there are things out there that really you can't find. I try to source things, and that would certainly be a delicious, you know, part of any kind of conspiracy theory, trying, you know, to track down exactly who killed Kennedy. But I can't find any evidence that he said that.
Earlier, I mentioned the President Kennedy Assassination Records Collection Act of 92 was signed into law by President George Herbert Walker Bush, and that some might find that ironic because some JFK researchers have maintained that Bush 41 was in Dallas that day, despite his protests to the contrary, that he did witness the assassination, that perhaps he was even standing outside the Texas Book Depository building. There is a popular picture circulating online. It's inconclusive. It could be a young, dashing George Herbert Walker Bush, or it might not be. As I say, it's inconclusive. But there are other clues. There's a memo from J. Edgar Hoover, an FBI memo. In the last paragraph, this is written the day after the assassination, and I think they're concerned about the potential for rioting or something in the wake of the assassination. And Hoover in this memo mentions that this information came from CIA field worker or field office worker George Herbert Walker Bush. So how much of this is true? How much do you believe? You know, where was Poppy Bush? All of these questions arise, his involvement.
Well, I think it's, and I think that picture and the theory that George Bush was somehow directly involved in assassination probably became popular either during his administration or W. Bush's administration, because obviously the Bushes were high-profile figures at that point. But if you look back, Bush would have been a young guy. He certainly could have been connected to the CIA, and as you said, there's a mention of George H.W. Bush of the CIA, I believe it says. So certainly he could have had a connection. Apparently, you know, a lot of these guys did or do. And but I don't. You have to look at, okay, historically at that time, would he have been in a position of prominence to be like a major figurehead in the assassination? I don't think so. I think people make that same mistake when they try to say that the Bushes or the Clintons directly, you know, ordered the assassination of JFK Jr. and so forth. Whereas I think these things happen, but I think they happen at higher levels. I don't think, same thing with the JFK assassination. I think LBJ had prior knowledge. I think he was real happy about it. He certainly would have objected to it. He profited, he got his goal to become president that he'd always wanted. But I don't think he could have been the mastermind. I think these things are ordered above the level of politicians. So when people point to a Bush or LBJ or anybody, Clinton, I think that things happen at a higher level than that. And so that's why I kind of shy away, because I just don't think that, especially in that case, a young George, he could have been there. That may very well be him in the picture. And he could have known about it. I mean, because, you know, again, his father was a powerful senator, Prescott Bush. So he certainly was used to being in the halls of power. So, but I just don't think he could have played that kind of a prominent role.
The fabled meeting at Clint Murchison's place, oil magnate, that was attended by, we're told, sort of a who's who of power brokers from Texas and elsewhere. LBJ supposedly attended the meeting and afterwards told his mistress, Madeline Duncan Brown, that after tomorrow, that SOB Kennedy will never embarrass me again. What do you make of Madeline Duncan Brown? Is she credible, or, well, she's no longer with us. Was she credible?
I think Madeline Brown was like a lot of witnesses. I think her story was probably basically true. I think there probably was some kind of party like that. I think she could easily have been the mistress of LBJ. He certainly was known to be a womanizer. But I think a lot of the people that are connected to this case, what happens when the researchers get a hold of them, they end up, well, it's just human nature, I think, to maybe exaggerate. I think we see this with Judith Berry Baker, as far as if they actually maybe, there's some truth there, I think. But I think when people get a hold of them and they develop kind of a fan base, maybe, their egos kind of want to make themselves seem a little bit more important than what they were. So I don't know that any of those figures are really that I think they're peripheral figures, and they hear these things. Certainly, I have no doubt that LBJ could have said something like that, but he may have just done it in anger because, I think he knew that JFK was going to be killed. I think he had prior knowledge, but I just don't think he did it like he ordered it because he was mad at him. I think he was happy that it was happening, and maybe JFK had angered him one final time, and he just forgot himself and said something like that to Madeline Brown. But I don't think these figures are something like Madeline. I think they're basically credible, but I think that's just kind of human nature. We saw that with Roger Craig, who was a great deputy sheriff. But as time went on and the researchers started talking to him, he did change some things. But, you know, his initial testimony is very important. In fact, he was apparently the only deputy sheriff that day in Dallas doing his job. So I think these figures are important, but they have to recognize human nature. And when they're not really dealing with law enforcement agencies or really establishment journalists most of the time, because professional reporters have always shied away from these subjects. So they're dealing with a citizen, you know, activist.
All right, Don, I got to jump in here. We'll take a timeout, come back. Bottom of the next hour, we'll open up the phone lines for Don Jeffries. Here's Tom Waits in the neighborhood on Coast to Coast AM.